Hello, and welcome back to We're Not So Different, a podcast about how we've always been idiots. My name is Luke. I'm an amateurish historian, and as always, I'm joined by Dr. Eleanor Yaniga, who is anything but. Today, we are finishing up our series on heresies, probably much to the happiness of some of you. But first we got a question, and this question actually came to us during our historical materialism series, and I've been holding it for a while because I wanted to do a series kind of about heresies and the Reformation. It's from the last time we talked about capitalism and Christianity and all that jazz. So yeah, but question from one of our patrons, Long Skate Death. Your discussion of Protestantism not necessarily equaling capitalism was the good level of nuance, as I've come to expect. It got me thinking about something related that I imagine it's probably coming up, perhaps in Historical Materialism episode 20 or 30. Ha! That I'm interested to hear your thoughts on. The leveler and digger movements, were they always going to fail given the power imbalance in English society of the day?
Oh, so this is a great question. And so for those who don't know, leveler and digger movements, they kind of come out, both of them, from the English Civil War. So the levelers are oftentimes more connected to what we call the War of the Three Kingdoms. Kind of like the varying like Scottish, Irish, English ones. And the diggers more so after the execution of Charles I. So they're both agrarian, and the diggers in particular are communists. And their deal is, okay, so the reason why we killed King Charles was because landowners are a fuck, kill all sovereign, 1640... nine, mm-hmm. Etc. And so they're like, okay, well, what needs to happen now is that land needs to be made available for poor people to cultivate it. Mm-hmm. And now this makes sense because of all the disruption of the Civil Wars, food prices were hugely high, just like really fucked. And so they're kind of like, well, yeah, this is a benefit to everyone. And they were especially kind of like going in on common lands and being like, look, this is what's up. Like, we're actually going to do more cultivation on common land as opposed to keeping it for grazing and things like that. This ends up pissing the Commonwealth government off, because basically they like, some of them are the local landowners and they're like, hey, no, I didn't mean everybody, just not the king, right? So basically they get harassed the entire time. There's violence, there's legal action against them. And they did manage to set up a colony in Surrey at St. George's Hill. But it basically collapses eventually. The levelers are a more extensive kind of movement. And like kind of really before the Second Civil War is when they're at their top. And they get a lot more support than the diggers do. A lot of them are supported by like the City of London and the New Model Army. And so basically they write this cool manifesto, which is really neat, which is called An Agreement of the People. And it kind of like talks about like how society should be set up. And, basically, surprise, surprise, they mean like, let's be fair. Like, why not treat peasants like people? Things of this nature. And they had a really good organization going. They were organized at a national level. So they got, like, offices. Like, they were set up in various inns. They recruited really well. They had their own newspaper. They're called levelers because basically they... Like, it's one of these things where it was a slur, kind of, for rural rebels that is, like, connected to the Midland Revolt. That happened because of the Enclosure Act. And then they kind of like took it on as like a badge of pride. Anyway, so they eventually, like, they've got like real big political ambitions. They want to do all sorts of things, but then they are eventually crushed because nobody likes how the poor folks are kind of like getting uppity. I would argue that it's not inevitable that either of these movements are crushed, because it was theoretically possible, I think, especially with the levelers, Like the levelers had real political power, they had real backers, and they were kind of making some points that needed to be made. And essentially, if you can get London on side, a lot of the time you have a chance at actually bringing everybody along with you. And I would say that kind of what happens to the levelers more is that they're taken down by the generalized chaos of, like they head back into the Second World War and then, like, sorry, Second World War, into the Second Civil War, and then what are you going to do? And I mean, I think that really what screws them over is this chaos, right? And here it's a story too that is important to kind of like keep in mind, where it's like, Cromwell doesn't like these guys. And like he kind of like goes after people who support them specifically. So it's important for us to kind of like keep in mind, this isn't necessarily about monarchical ideas. It's about the fact that a lot of people be bootlickers. And it's like it's about how wealth is distributed, and so say what you like about, Puritans and them being like, oh, holier than thou and this sort of thing. They still want to control the money, right? They still want to control the land. And do I think that there's something in the British psyche that really responds to that? Yeah, absolutely. But it's also hard for me to say because we're kind of like 500 years later or whatever. And it's kind of like, well, would we have got here one way or another? I don't know. I don't like to necessarily think that history is all always going to be the way that it is. And I think that especially the levelers gave it a good shot. I think that it's just rich people really do have a lot of power, and that's very, very difficult to fight against unless you can bring everyone on side with you, I think, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. I mean, I think the only thing I would add to that is I would say that I don't think anything in history is like totally and completely inevitable. It can change, it can be delayed, stuff like that. Like, there was always going to be a Reformation, but like the time and place and when it happened and who was involved and where it stopped, blah blah blah, all that sort of stuff was subject to change. And if any of that stuff changes, it changes the nature and character of the Reformation as we understand it now. But this is one of those things where I think, especially with the diggers, maybe with the levelers, but especially with the diggers, like, it is as close to a absolute certainty, a rule of like the physical realm, that the diggers were going to be crushed at this point. I think because of, I mean, class consciousness hadn't taken hold. They like across the board, like, and these people, the diggers were, I mean, they appear to have all been very serious about this and very, ready to do it. But at the same time, it was a few like quasi wealthier type people, and they got together and had these changes of heart and wanted to do something, and they kind of went out there, and then everywhere they showed up, they were just like driven back into the countryside because nobody wanted them around. And I think it's really hard. I think it's really hard. Not that nobody wanted them around, nobody in power wanted them around. I think it's really hard for them to, I think it's really hard to overcome that in that day and age, in that era. Just like that, just the, it's the same thing with Wat Tyler, like, and the English Peasants' Rebellion, like, or Peasants' Revolt rather. Wat Tyler wasn't doomed to fail. There was, maybe like a slim chance that, like, he could have gotten in and waged a big enough war that it was a big enough problem that there was some, reform here and there or something like that. He was never going to become like the king or anything, but you know what I'm saying, like, and so when this happens, you just kind of get, you kind of get all the forces like in power attacking this at the same time, and they don't have the methods of mass communication as readily available yet. They don't have like that would come along, especially with the French Revolution and stuff, like, which is, 150 years later or 140 years later. And so I think it's just one of those things where it's like, they weren't necessarily 100% doomed to fail, but like it was going to be very, very, very difficult. And with the levelers, if you've got someone like Cromwell against you, like,
Yeah.
Once he got to that level of power, like, I guess it was probably after he went to Ireland or whatever. I'm not as up on the English Civil Wars as I am on other things, but once he gets to that level of power and he's basically like the king in all but name, mm-hmm. I mean, if he doesn't like you, you're done at that point.
Yeah, that's and it.
I
mean, that's it. Yeah, completely.
But I mean, yeah. Like, if they could have, like, penetrated a little bit more, the levelers, if they could have penetrated into, like, the government a little bit before that, mm-hmm. I mean, sure. Like, I mean, yeah, you could, like, just because things are bad in England now, things are bad in America now, doesn't mean that there haven't been times in the past where history could have been completely different. Like we talked about during the historical materialism series, you know, Henry Wallace, who was FDR's vice president, and was probably a communist kind of dupe and probably wouldn't have led us into the Cold War, definitely not the way Truman did. Same thing with like Benjamin Butler being refusing to be Lincoln's VP and that it going to Andrew Johnson. It's like you know, you got these things and they could have changed for the better. Unfortunately, history ended up the way it did. But, you know, like, I mean, I think there's always a small chance for some of that stuff to happen. But, you know, you have to have everything fall your way.
Yeah. Oh, I completely agree. And I think that, you know, these are like really quite interesting things because, you know, for example, I think that the Diggers are really, you know, they remind me a lot of what's going on, for example, with the Taborites in the Hussite mm-hmm. rebellion, you mm-hmm. know, and they'd just be like, no, fuck it. We're going communist. Right. And to a certain extent, you know, that is something that you can get away with unless you piss a certain person off.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? So like, yeah. It's interesting to see how these sentiments have always been there, but if you can't bring more people on side, inevitably you're going to fail. Mm-hmm. And like this is the thing about revolution is it requires buy-in from a larger yeah. community. So I mean, I think you've hit the nail on the head there, you know, right?
Yeah, like I mean, you know, in all of these instances with the German peasants, you know, and the Taborites and, you know, these radical sects of Christianity, mm-hmm. you know, you see that there is like this yearning by some of these people to be like, yes, I want to go further. I want to take this to its logical yeah. extent. If Jesus saved me and I'm a lower noble, and the Bible says Jesus died for us all, then we're all the same thing. And we're going to apply this like we're going to apply this how you should apply it. And, you know, in every case, you just see the backlash. The Diggers just get thrown out. The Levelers, you know, to a lesser extent, but it kind of happens to them. And mm-hmm, mm-hmm. like you said, the Taborites were like wiped out. And, you know, we know what happened to the Anabaptists and, you know, all of those groups that tried to go anywhere towards land reform in mm-hmm. Germany. So it's like, you know, I don't know that it's impossible, but the factors have probably not gotten there for the trajectory of history for it to work because you don't have the mass movement level yet and you don't have the people coalesced into such an area where you can do that because, again, industrialism hasn't really taken hold yet. And, yeah. you know, the cities are about in England are about to start growing, you know, big, like huge, but, you know, it's not there yet. And you need that stuff. You know, it's not like these people failed and we should be like, ah, ha, ha, they suck. These idiots failed. Yeah. It's more like, you know, we should understand their historical place and be like, you know, okay, these are the factors that were going against them. And, you know, that is why they failed. It wasn't for a lack of, initiative or, you know, anything like that. It's, you know, it's just like,
absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. You just, you know, sometimes you know, born too early to whatever, born too late to whatever, you know,
For sure.
Sometimes you just are. And that's just, it sucks, but that's how it is. Yeah. So, thank you so much for the question.
Love it.
You know, I've been holding that one a long time. And sorry about that. Just do it sometimes because I think they'll be useful. And then, you know, this is what happens like over a year later. But anyway, thank you so much, Lunkskate Death, for the question. If you want to ask us questions like that we will answer here, maybe next episode, maybe in a year and a half. By all means, please subscribe to the Patreon, patreon.com/WNSDpod. You get regular episodes ad-free, bonus episodes. We just put out another little mailbag episode that was a lot of fun. You get two bonus episodes a month. And yeah, so just check it out. And it's just $5 a month, and it really helps us out. We appreciate it.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, you're fine.
Okay. Yeah, so on to the main show. The 1648 Peace of Westphalia should have been the end of this series. Westphalia was, after all, the event that saw the Catholic Church and its nation-state allies abandon once and for all the idea of reinstating Catholic hegemony across Europe. Because whatever might be said about the actual contents of the Peace of Westphalia and how many pieces and treaties it actually was, blah, 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 the signatories and other major players about Europe understood what it meant in practice. The end of confessional conflict in continental Europe. There'd be no more wars between big nation states or tiny principalities to determine the confessional nature or the confessional form of Christianity that would predominate in each. Now, it might change over time or something like that, but, you know, there are no more crusades against the Hussites, etc., etc. They would still fight over land and titles and resources, and they'd try to enforce their own confessions on colonial holdings and subjects, but the European wars of religion were over. This victory of religious toleration, however loosely you want to define that term, for the heretical Protestant reformers would have made a fitting bookend to a series on heresies that began 1,323 years before, with the Catholic Church coming into power and branding Arius and his followers heretics. It opened with heresy and the promise of Catholic dominance in the offing. It closed with the biggest heresy and promise of fading Catholic importance in global affairs. And yet, here we are. Sure, the Peace of Westphalia is a good place to leave off, but that would mean we didn't get to do a proper conclusion for the series, or talk about how all those heresies still affect us today, namely the Puritans. Despite roundly mocking them, as is our wont, we've never really had a chance to look at them in any depth, and how they're just an extension of all the shit we've covered in the series up to this point. Also, it's funny that they were persecuted and were the first ones to kind of figure out you actually need to kill the king in a revolution, but then refused to fully assume power and were once again consigned to persecution, but then kind of flourished in America. And yeah, it's yep. So that's what we'll do today. We're going to talk about them, why they hated fun, and why they got shipped off to the New World. And then we'll do a bit of a summation of the series as a whole and look at the arc of the Catholic Church throughout everything. Spoiler, it's been one massive ongoing L since 1517. Mm-hmm. Next time, we'll do something probably on the various religious orders that cropped up throughout the Middle Ages, like the Franciscans, since we didn't really focus on them very much in the series, and we got a question about it. Yeah, so that's what we'll do next time. But yeah, today, Eleanor, who were the first Puritans, and how'd they get started in jolly old England?
Okay, so what I love about the Puritans is that in many ways they come out of this, it's something we don't talk about very often, which is the vestments controversy or the vestarian controversy. I like to say vestarian controversy because it's a good word. Right? So it kicks off basically around a rejection of clerical vestments, hence the term, right? So basically being like, should priests be wearing silly clothes?
So, you gotta wear a vest. See my vest.
Right? And it's like,
see my vest. Yep.
This starts under this guy, John Hooper. And he was kind of like, he was one of the big, Protestant martyrs, right? And a big, he was very pro-Reformation, right? And he was kind of saying that priests shouldn't be getting all dolled up under Edward VI, RIP, who's only a child or whatever. And so he gets got, obviously, during Mary's reign, when she comes in and tries to re-Catholicize everyone, and then this comes back again under Elizabeth I, right? So basically, the idea is that, like, well, do clothes, ease the distinction of clergy from regular people, edifying, is what they say. Mm-hmm. So it's like, so is it definitely beneficial? So it's like, this is a thing that comes out of Corinthians, and it's like, so when you come together, everyone has a psalm, has a doctrine, has a tongue, has a revelation, has an interpretation, and let all done be edifying. So it's like, okay, well, is it edifying that priests dress differently, right? And then basically, you have this thing in 1559 called the Act of Uniformity, which is basically saying that, like, the monarch has the authority to say what it is that people are going to wear, like, for the edifying of the church, right? Anyway, the Puritans think no. They're like, they are really like 100%, like, they do not want. Like they don't want priests to wear in fancy clothes. And also what they want is like parliamentary support to institute kind of like what's called a Presbyterian form within the Church of England. So it's like basically there's a church, they want a church government so that there are like, you know, regular people who make these decisions, not necessarily just the queen, right? So, basically, they don't like. Also, they don't like the queen says that you can dress however you want. A, they're like, and then that they're like, and another thing, the queen shouldn't be doing this at all whatsoever. And so they are just like sometimes called separatists. So they think that there should
Ooh.
be a separation of church and state, right? And that basically the covenant of God, stop me if you've heard this one before, exists among yourselves, right? And not between the queen and God, and then that it's something that you commune with, right? So anyway, Elizabeth is like, absolutely get fucked. Like
No.
that's like cute for you, but absolutely not, right? And so they're like, okay, well, what we are gonna do instead is we're gonna start our own religion with preaching and pamphlets. And they basically like start an organization where they kind of start, they hit all of the big things that you expect like Lutherans to do, right? And it, the thing of it is some people really kind of like it. It takes off in Parliament. And they really importantly get really high up in the colleges at Oxford and Cambridge, right? Because this is like a really fun little scholastic idea, right? Where they're like, oh, well, I would like to put these ideas forward, right? Then enter James, you know, noted weirdo, as we say. And they're like, oh, okay, well, he's a fucking weirdo, right? So, like, he's gonna come along with us on this because he's all for witch hunting and everything. So, like, this should be the good, right? Anyway, there's this thing called the Hampton Court Conference in 1604, and they all get together, and James is like, no. And like he's like like we're not going to do that. The phrase here is no bishop, no king. Like you can't like you need the kind of like a hierarchy. And of course the king's gonna fucking say that, right? So they then all get kicked out of all of their positions, like they lose all of their chairs at Oxford and everything like that. And then some of them run the fuck off to the continent. Is the thing. And often where they run the fuck off to the continent is like Calvinist strongholds.
Geneva. Like, hey,
Geneva. Like,
Geneva.
woo, what's up? Like, here we are, right?
I'm gonna become more Calvinist. I'm just gonna fucking do
Yeah, exactly, right. So they go away to get weirder, right?
Yeah.
But like people are still kind of into it. You know, no one really likes James. He's perceived as being like a weirdo and kind of like foreign and whatever, you know. And then in comes Charles, and everyone is like, this guy is definitely a crypto Catholic. And so the Puritans basically then are like, okay, well, that is it. Like now's the moment. And Parliament essentially calls together like a bunch of clergy and says, okay, well, how should the government of the church be composed? This is called the Westminster Assembly. But they just argue like a lot. And then basically like enter the new model army who had like been fighting with royalist forces. And then they're kind of worried that assembly and parliament are going to like actually compromise in a way that like Charles is gonna win, and they're not gonna get anything in terms of Puritanism. And so they're like, nope, Oliver Cromwell time, right? And so, anyway, this is how you get Puritans, right?
Yeah.
They fucking suck. It starts with priest drip. This is what it's about, which is like a kind of a fucking stupid. But yeah, they're kind of like, what if you turn up the volume on Calvinists?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're basically a nice little extension of, Calvinist and everything that's been going that way on the continent for a long time. You know, it started coming over. Mm-hmm. They hate Christmas.
Yeah,
they hate fun.
Yeah, they're like, if you are having fun, they get so fucking mad, dude. Mm-hmm. They do not want that at all. They're not big on dancing. That's a big thing for them. A big thing for them is like plain clothing. They really don't like kind of Anglicanism as it's set up. Mm-hmm. I'm not a fan of the idea of a king being the head of the church. They don't like all the stuff that I think is cool, like smells and bells. They hate that.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, I swear, if I see any incense, I'm gonna fucking riot.
They're bringing back all the classics, iconoclasm, mm-hmm. Clerical issues with the clergy, whatever mm-hmm. the clergy may be. They got issues with it.
They don't like the Book of Common Prayer.
saying that the Anglicans are just up jump Catholics trying to make themselves look better. Which, I mean, hey, they got that one right.
I mean,
at least,
they but, got you know, their ass on that one.
They kind of grow a little during Elizabethan times, and then under James people are like, you guys are weirdos. Mm-hmm. And then they get fairly heavily persecuted for a little while in the early 1600s, and in 1620 famously, a group of Puritans known as the Pilgrims, settle the New England colony in America. And this is an example of a practice that America would learn very well from England, and that is using colonial land as an outlet for religious dissidents or social outcasts who you don't want to deal with.
Yes.
And hoo boy, did we ever learn it from watching you, Dad? Because, yeah, I mean, this is like the Puritans basically, the Puritan religion in America is only around for a little over 100 years, and then it kind of dies out. But Eleanor, how did this like humble religious sect that wasn't officially endorsed by the ruling English metropole at the time and, wasn't the universal religion of all parts of America? How did it come to dominate America and really be embedded in our foundation of the country?
I mean, literally, I think it just comes down to they got here first, right? So this isn't to say that there weren't other trading blocks. You know, of course, the mm-hmm. Dutch are all set up on Manhattan, and there's all kinds of weird things going on.
And Jamestown had been there for a decade or so, but yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, there are all these other little things that are going on. But this is the first kind of like big, permanent, what you would call colonial settlement. Because even with New Amsterdam and stuff in New York, the Dutch are still mostly perceiving it as a trading outpost. And that's kind of how it exists. Whereas what the Puritans say is that they are coming to the New World, quote unquote, and they are going to set up the ideal Puritan society. Mm-hmm. And they are going to establish it based on specifically Puritan values. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so within this, there is, all the stuff that, Americans have kind of like taken to the nth degree and, made the worst possible decisions about. So this includes like rugged individualism, that like your spirituality is like your responsibility. And that's kind of a thing that's happening. But also at the same time, a kind of collective policing of that. Mm-hmm. So, if you don't get on with people, you can get kicked out. And then it's like, well, Good luck out there with all the natives you've been persecuting.
We'll send you to Pennsylvania or Rhode Island. Get the fuck out.
Yeah, yeah. Right? And it's like, and this is the thing. So, like, Pennsylvania, like, shout out to my boys, the Quakers, a group of Christians that I actually really like. You know, they show up and they settle Pennsylvania, but not until much, much later, right? Mm-hmm. And they certainly have a lot of political sway in America, but the thing about the Puritans is they come to dominate the coastlines, which means that they are really dominating, especially kind of like trade and kind of like movements in and out, like things that go back and forth to England. So they've got this sort of stranglehold in New England initially, where they control the money in a lot of ways. And that gives them a certain kind of cachet that the other groups don't have. So, like, the Quakers, because they're further back in Pennsylvania, you know, it's like, literally, you are not in the port cities, so what are you going to do? And sure, you get, like, little Catholic strongholds, you know, like, I mean, so, well, big one, like Maryland, right? You know, you eventually set up a bunch of Catholics down there and that kind of a thing, but that's much later along. And you got to understand that, you know, a lot of the people who become the quote-unquote founding fathers, you know, they are from New England. Right. Mm-hmm. Like, that's what those guys are doing. Like, and sure, there are like plenty of Southerners in there and stuff. I'm not saying that there aren't, but they're coming out of this tradition that is really steeped in, you know, the Bible is like a literal truth, which is something that you need to interpret. There is a need for communities to be based upon these ideals, and they are going to be like very, very heavily policed and controlled as a result of it. And we've never really got away from that because they were the first ones to ever do it, right? So even when, you know, you have nice guys like the Quakers show up and try to pull this stuff off. I mean, like, as nice as any settler colonists can be, you know, like, well, I'm going to be real, team natives. You know, they're kind of doing it based on what the Puritans are doing. So they're going, oh, yeah, and that's great. And we'll do that, too. And we'll have the Quaker version of that. That'll be nice. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's always like based on this model of that's what being, you know, a colonist in America is. And that just gets in everybody's heads. Right.
Yeah.
Plus, they're fucking dicks and they'll just fight with you about it. So, you know.
Something I've always found interesting is how, you know, these colonies, there were a lot of pilgrims, a lot of, you know, Puritans at the time. And they, you know, have colonies, they have families, it, you know, becomes this thing. And then when we get to the Constitutional Convention, and you have these people like Jefferson and Franklin and a lot of these people are intellectuals and are intellectually like deists, which essentially, you know, God made everything and set the world in motion, and then he just left it alone. You know, basically the long and the short of it. So they, you know, they made room for, like, yeah, okay, something happened, there was a God, it was created, you know, and that's going to be kind of a little bit of a backbone of a lot of the stuff we're doing. But they kept the, like, Protestant work ethic. They kept the, like, more, a lot of them kept the morality police shit. They kept, you know, they kept, like, the, you know, don't get out of your station. Like, they kept a lot of this stuff. So even like, from they got here in 1620 to the 1780s when the Constitutional Convention was, you know, it's 160 years, and, like, you know, in that time you already see, like, the way that America treats, you know, religion, like, you take away a lot of it, you fit it into the contours of how can I live within capital and maximize myself and my era and my family within capital, and, you know, the rest of it just kind of gets abstracted, but we keep the shit that, you know, is needed to enforce it.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, I suppose there's something to say here, too, also just about demography and what they managed to pull off here, right? So it's like, there you go. There's the embedded idea of, like, what it means to be an American and, like, you know, this kind of, like, Calvinist bootstrap work ethic, blah, 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 right? But another big thing that really works in the Puritans' favor, like, I mean, roundabout during, like, the big immigration There are only about 21,000 English people come across, mm-hmm. right? But they breed like rabbits.
yeah.
It's kind of the thing. So they start sucking and fucking immediately. They have
not sucking. Only
well, yeah,
fucking.
Actually, only fucking. Only fucking. Yeah, yeah, sorry about that. And they have just absolutely tons of kids. And this is kind of like a differentiation point to what's going on over in England, because there's room in yeah. America, right? So it's like you can build a house. There's trees to cut things down, and you can just build a big old house, and you can like shove some kids in it, and that's fine. There's also, compared to Europe, where you have a much denser population of people, a lot fewer kind of infectious diseases that rip through, mm-hmm. Just because there are, you've got more room to move about. So the death rate is a lot lower mm-hmm. in the colonies. And then, so there's this other thing that they do too, which is they kind of like move around then. So like then some of them are like, okay, well, I'm actually going to go down to Virginia, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm gonna do stuff down there. Some of them move to the Caribbean and have like slave plantations there and this sort of mm-hmm. a thing. So all in all, after about 150 years, right? Mm-hmm. Or so, you've got 700,000 people living in yeah. the New England colonies, which is like from 21,000 people in, you know, 1640. Yeah. That's absolutely crazy, right? Like that's yeah. that is just huge numbers of people. So this helps to create the circumstances whereby these hegemonic ideas are kind of reiterated, right? Because like everyone who's there has come out of this, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like, sure, you can like ship some, you know, Irish indentured servants over all you want, but they came over as indentured servants, and they're always going to be second class people. So mm-hmm. like the established ethos is going to be Puritan, it's going to be Protestant, and that's what this kind of means. And also, there are just so many of them, right?
Yeah,
like absolutely tons of them. And now, like, granted, a lot of, especially the original ones, get over to New England and they're like, no, thank you.
Yep. You know? They're like, nah, I'm good. I'm out.
Because it's a lot of work, right? Like, I mean, mm-hmm. part of the Protestant work ethic thing that comes out of here is that it's like, oh, well,
What you need to do to start a colony, basically.
Yeah, yeah, basically. Yeah. It's like, you know, it's kind of like all the fucking trads now who are like, oh, yeah, I want a homestead and all this stuff. It's like, I don't think you understand how much work that yeah. involves, right? So they're doing all this fucking work, like, you know, they're clearing forests, they're starting farms, and it's like this, it helps to have a bunch of kids, right? Because someone's got to shuck all this goddamn corn, right? So it's like right. the demographic thing kind of goes along with that. And then kind of another thing to keep in mind is this is also the milieu which starts like the first educational systems within America, right? So it's like Puritans who set up the Boston Latin School. And like that's like the first formal education like place in the Americas, right?
Mm-hmm.
And like so you kind of bake in Puritan ideals and Calvinist ideals about like what it means to be a worker, what it means to be a good Christian, right into the educational system from the get-go.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, and one thing about Puritans that I will give them is because they are pamphleteers and everything, mm-hmm. they are really big on literacy.
Yeah.
Because, like, they, you know, they're writing their weird little zines.
And you have to be able to read to understand the Word of God. Like, yeah. I mean, that mm-hmm. is, I have no doubt, you know, that that it's overblown, but there is a lot to the fact that, like, once the Reformation happens, a lot of people are like, well, if I'm going to do this, I have to learn to, you have to learn to read, because yeah. because if I don't, then my preacher could be faking out of the Bible, like mm-hmm. the dirty papists do. Like,
yeah.
I mean,
it's
a reinforcing thing, and so reading becomes a, you know, a very big deal to a lot of these people. So yeah
and you know, I too really like reading, so mm-hmm. like, unfortunately, like, and this is the problem with Protestants, is like, I fucking hate them, mm-hmm. like one of the worst groups of individuals that ever lived as far as mm-hmm. I'm concerned, but they have these things where I'm like, yeah, you know what,
mm-hmm.
Anglicism is kind of like Catholicism, but you got a king. I'll give it to you. It is good to read. Do I think that it's probably good to have a personalized, you know, relationship to spirituality? Sure. Yeah, that's good. You know what I don't like? Double predestination. Yeah. Right?
Like, yeah, that's one of the other interesting things is by this point, like, the Puritans, you know, like any pretense that John Calvin himself had with the predestination thing of trying to make it something where you aren't drowning in your own neuroses constantly, religious neuroses about like a cold God who's going to send you to hell for like almost anything, even a single sinful thought, is like, that's gone. Like, that is completely out of Calvinism, and it is just whittled down to the bone of, like, you have to be so fucking neurotic about not only your own personal morality, but the morality of other people you see, because if they're sinning and you don't do something, you don't say something, you don't admonish them, you are also sinning in that fact. And it's like, again, it's just this constantly reinforcing cycle of, like, Protestantism didn't cause capitalism, but capitalism took Protestantism and latched it onto the outside, whether it was Anglicanism or Reformed or Calvinism or whatever it was. They latched it on there and they were like, look, you are responsible for your own salvation, which means you have to work your ass off all the time and you can't take a break, and you're neurotic, you have to police everyone around you, and you have to be like constantly doing these things, otherwise you're thinking about how God is going to send you to hell for all eternity. Yeah. And you can see how, like, we say, you know, Protestantism didn't directly cause capitalism, but you can also see at the same time how capitalism, like, took that and used it and made it the window dressing for what it would become, because those are very useful ideological concepts, which, while they may have been filtering into the Catholic, or not may have, they were definitely filtering into the Catholic Church, Protestants basically began with that stuff. Like, that is a foundational aspect of Protestantism. Yeah, it's nuts. Yeah. But before we go on and kind of wrap everything up, we do have one more thing, because back in England, the Puritans have one flash. They have one just huge moment where they go from being persecuted in the 1620s onto a meteoric rise, and they kill king and rule
over England under Cromwell. Unfortunately, yes. It whips to kill the king.
I will give you one thing. They literally were the first ones in Western culture. Obviously, the mandate of heaven and stuff like that in other cultures have been there for a long time. But they were the first ones in Western culture to figure out that, like, going up to the king and being like, we love the king, but, you know, we want him to make some changes, doesn't work. Now, it took them a long time of agonizing and being fucking neurotic about it, but they did it, and that was definitely a precedent in Paris 140 years later. Like, you gotta give it one thing. You gotta really hand it to them, because they did it. They chopped a king's head off on a block, and the world didn't implode when it happened. You know,
that's just. Insane. It's great. I mean, I don't even really know how to say, like what is it? What is it about these motherfuckers? I think it's kind of Oliver Cromwell.
Yeah.
Like, I don't like great man theory. You know, that's not a thing.
Cult of personality around a single guy. There's no great men, but history puts some men and women in the position to be great, and yeah, I think he's probably one of those.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that the thing that he managed to do really good well was that he's a good recruiter, right? Yeah. He's a good recruiter for military dudes, and like, basically, I think that him getting together, like, he's like, he musters so many people in like the first English Civil War, right? And he manages to really get people together, And, you know, he's got all these successes in, like, East Anglia, and, you know, like, and then he's, like, the governor of the Isle of Ely later, and, you know, these things. So then he's, like, he's got, like, this kind of, like, important level where that he's able to kind of, like, keep on, right? Then you have, in 1644, Marston Moor, which is a battle where, like, basically, at this point in time, Cromwell is a lieutenant governor. And he is successful in breaking up the royalist cavalry out on Marston Moor. Okay. And so the yay parliamentarian victory, right? And basically, like, there's this big decisive outcome where they really, really win, but they don't manage to do much of it. So this sets up the new model army. Right. Because basically Parliament then makes this like a flying kind of like a Civil War chat. They make this ordinance called the self-denying ordinance, which means that members of the House of Commons and the Lords have to choose either they have a civil office or they have military command. Right. Like you can't have both of those things. And all of them, except for Cromwell, whose basic, like, all of his connections were, like, he was allowed to stay in Parliament, and be in the military, right? So he's, like, the one guy who was allowed to do both, and everyone else is like, oh, okay, well, fuck a military position. I'm gonna, like, stay in Parliament, because that's what this was all about, right? So then it's like, okay, well, and then the army needs to be remodeled, and it needs to be nationalist, and you shouldn't have, like, county associations. And Cromwell is like, yes, and I am very involved in these military reforms, right? So, like, he's able to have, you know, a foot in kind of both camps, right? And so basically then, like, they win a bunch of, like, other victories, right? And so by the time you have the second Civil War breakout, when they just can't, basically Charles just can't fucking get it together to make them all happy, here's this guy who's massively popular with the army specifically, right? And he's got all of this power within a Parliament, and he's a Puritan, right? And so that means that he is really, like, egging on the members of Parliament who are Puritans and being like, yeah, that's absolutely the way, woohoo. And then, you know, they get hold of the king, they kill the king, and then they establish Parliament, and here's fucking Cromwell at the end of that, and he's like, "Woo! Well, now that we've got here, I would like to genocide Ireland, hooray!" You know, and, like, and he does all these, like, this dickhead bullshit, awful stuff, like, with it. But I really think that kind of, like, the way that they take off is it's about him, and it's about the fact that, like, no one really saw it coming, because, like, who the fuck is he? Right. And it's just him having so much kind of, like, power in the army and in Parliament as well allows it to happen. But he just played everyone really effectively, both sides. But also, because of all of this, that's what sets you up for the great ejection later. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Another instance where the course of history changed on one person's decision, because, I mean, Cromwell was Lord Protector of England for 5 years, and at any point in that 5 year period, he could have gone and declared himself king, or abolished the monarchy entirely and gotten something else together. And, you know, maybe that doesn't stick around because his son's kind of a dingus or whatever, but, like, if he takes up that mantle and he really takes it on himself, and they, like, develop some kind of, like, actual, like, constitution or something like that, then you could see how history would be different, even if it was only, you know, like a 10-year thing or something like that. And then, you know, royalists came back into power. That would change a whole lot of the world and how things were going at that time. And it's just like, you just see this, and Cromwell just couldn't do it. He was too fucking neurotic. He was too, like, no, I cannot be king. I am not holy enough. God doesn't, blah, blah. And, like, they say he, like, prayed for, like, days and days and days. And, like, knowing Cromwell, I mean, he probably did pray for days. Like, just agonized over this decision, decided not to do it. And, you know, here we are.
Ugh, yeah, God.
That's how you get the Restoration and the Orange and all that.
Yeah. I'll tell you what, I fucking hate that guy. So, like, I'm glad that he didn't become king and everything. Like, that is good to me. I just really hate that this was our revolution here. You know, so, I mean, and I guess, yeah, it was, like, you know, Cromwell, like, fucking dies eventually, which is good, and everything like that. So he kind of dies, and in 1658, when I say kind of dies, he definitely dies. And he had, like, all kind of shit wrong with him. He had
not
malaria.
Dead yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right? Like, he had malaria. He had kidney stones. He was, like, you know, just, he was a decrepit shell of a man, which, good, rest in peace, hope it was painful, right? Mm-hmm. So anyway, he dies in kind of, like, 1658, and, like, what do you know? Like, they are unable to kind of, like, keep this whole protectorate thing going, right? Mm-hmm. So he gets buried in Westminster Abbey, and they're kind of, like, treating him like a king, even though he isn't. But, you know, here comes Charlie. He's back. And they're like, okay, look, what, we have got a king back again, and what we're going to do is this thing that's called the Act of Uniformity. That's in 1662. Mm-hmm. And basically it says, no, look, we're just going to establish what public prayer is, how we're doing sacraments, and, like, what it is in the Church of England. And technically the Puritans are all still within the Church of England at this point. That's what's, like, really important to keep in mind, is that, like, they aren't a completely separate movement. They are technically Anglican. And the issue for them is, Charles is like, Book of Common Prayer, homeboy! Yeah, that's my shit! Like, love the Book of Common Prayer. And the Puritans are like, that is the one fucking thing that we didn't want. Because Puritans think that you shouldn't have written prayers. They're like, prayers should always be coming from the heart, and they should be inspired by God all the time, right? So you get this group of people called the Dissenters, who are like, absolutely not. We're not going to come down on this side. And basically they get kicked the fuck out of the church, which I think is funny. Like, I think that's good.
It is funny the extent to which within 4 years they had started purging the Puritans from, within 4 years of Oliver Cromwell's death, they were like, all right, well, that was fun. Anyway, we got a king back. Fuck you guys.
Imagine how difficult this is for me, because I'm like, on the one hand, I hate, it's, like, I'm incredibly, like, guy sweating over buttons memes, which is like, the fucking Puritans get owned and the monarchy gets owned, and I'm like, oh, you know, like,
yeah, exactly. Like, it's just, yeah, it's just, man, they just fucking, they, like, you had a lot of the factors there, but they just couldn't bring it all together. And part of it was just because Cromwell was like, no, God, whatever God sounds like in my head told me not to do this. And it's like, all right, well, I mean, I guess, you know, you had a chance to really just take total absolute power and didn't do it. So that's,
yeah,
I guess something. But the rest of your life was pretty much awful. So,
So basically, this establishes a group of Protestants who are kind of Puritans, who we call the nonconformists. So when you see nonconformists, they're usually, like, we're usually talking about kind of like English Puritans, sort of. And they're like, no, fuck the Act of Uniformity. Me and all my homies hate the Act of Uniformity. But now it kind of means, like, anybody, like a Quaker could be a nonconformist or whatever. It's just kind of like people who are like, I'm not going along with what the Church of England says. And it fucks your life up. Like, basically, so it's like you're not allowed to, like, hold public office. You can't have university degrees. Like, it does all these things that, like, it basically says that you are persona non grata, which is great for the colonies, right? Because you can still get on a boat, right? And go on over there. Like, yeah, so it's like there's a fresh wave, essentially, of Puritans as a result of it. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the Puritans still shaping our lives to this very day. The last and final heresy that we're going to cover, because this series has gone on, and we are firmly out of the medieval period, and that really bothers some people for some reason.
Yeah, well, I've got to teach it. Yeah. To, you know, in class, then you have to listen to me rant about it. Although I agree that the medieval period is better. I want to make that clear. Like, but, you know, let Eleanor have her ranty time, so.
That's right, yeah, yeah. So let's wrap it up. We've covered several dozen heresies in greater or lesser depth over the past 11 episodes. So what can we learn broadly about the church from this? How did it handle these heresies?
Yeah, so the thing that I want everyone to take away from this is that heresy fundamentally is just down to what whoever in power says is a heresy, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like, so in very many ways, you can say that heresies are created by the church, right? Mm-hmm. Like, sure, they're the result of personal belief on the part of individuals or groups of individuals. Yeah, absolutely. And but provided the church is fine with it, that's all good. And like, we'll talk about this when we get to the Franciscans, right? Where that shit's knife's edge, where it's like, it really could have gone either way, but the church says it's all good, so it's all good, right? Mm-hmm. I'm writing this article about Hildegard of Bingen today, and like, the Pope goes and checks her out, right? Like, the Pope's like, what? I hear someone's being a mystic. And, you know, they send guys up there, and their Pope says, nope, it's all good. Boom. So it's all good, right? Like, and that's basically getting that stamp. What makes a heretic is therefore things that threaten kind of the unity of the church, or, you know, the Church of England in some cases, or threaten like genuine political power, because it needs to be enough of a threat for the church to even fucking notice, right?
Yeah.
It's like, if you were just like some guy who's saying something crazy and you live in like, I don't know, the Highlands of Scotland, odds are you can go ahead and get away with that and you'll live your whole life being a heretic, and that's fine, like, even if it's out of commune with the Catholic Church. But by the time the church is aware that you exist, you are very well fucked if they don't like you. And that's just a judgment call. They get to make that decision. That's what makes heresy. That's what makes the Puritans bad and then good, like good and then bad, right? Because it's like, it's all well and good when they're in charge, and then the minute you get a king back, they're like, now fuck you, get the hell out of here, right? Like, the thing about heresy is that what makes a heretic is you threatening power. And that's kind of like really it. So, and like, what does that sound like, right? Like, that it sounds like everything that we kind of like go through in the modern world today, where it's like, you know, what's a terrorist, right?
Yep.
Like, you can think about terrorism in exactly the same way that you think about heresy, where it's like, well, does this threaten the status quo? Right.
Yeah. In Atlanta, last weekend, they arrested a bunch of people who were at like a concert protesting this big cop training facility they're trying to build in Atlanta. And they arrested like 70 people and have slapped like domestic terrorism charges on all of them. And they were just at a concert. Like, So they're just using the same shit, same shit, different, you know, same heresy.
Yep, exactly. And it's like, you know, why is it that like the groups that are constantly being infiltrated by cops are like environmentalists and not white supremacists? I'll tell you why. You know, it's like, because one threatens the status quo and another doesn't. And it's about troubling it, right? You know, the moment that you're troubling power, that's when it's decided that something needs to come down.
Yeah. So we've talked about a good number of them, but what is your favorite heresy that we've discussed, or the one that's most interesting to you?
I mean, we're not going to say Hussites because like that's too obvious. That's true. We're not going to go down on that one, but I love the good men and women of Languedoc. And the reason I like them is that either you're like one of these true believers and you definitively are like, oh yeah, like I've got this different way of seeing the world and I'm a part of this new organized church and this is what my deal is. Or you're like, I wanted to fuck. Like, and I just think it's not, I like how they're just so messy, right? I like how you, like, you can't, like, when you say the word Cathar, it's like, well, what the fuck does that mean? Because it's like, they don't call themselves that. Is this just someone who was like quite horny and used this as an excuse to like get where I love that. I just think that they're such weird little guys. And I'll never get tired of them, I don't think.
Yeah.
What about you?
I like the Bogomils. Yeah. Bogomils, let's go. I like, Yeah, you're like a Gnostic, like mystic types. Like, I mean, like I can vibe with that a lot more. You know, they're just out there. They don't, you know, they're just out there in I guess what is it now? Eastern, Western Russia, and they're like, no,
Nah.
leave us alone.
And I dig that, right? Really love
The
that
church
shit.
is like, no thanks, no thanks. Yeah. So, yeah, coming to the end, I guess it's kind of obvious, but at the same time, after the Reformation started, why did the Catholic efforts at a counter-reformation fail? And did they ever have a chance of like actually succeeding? By actually succeeding here, I mean like
Like retaking the Holy Roman Empire?
retaking the Holy Roman Empire and like cordoning Lutheranism off to like, you know, the Duchy of Prussia or something like that, the way they had with Hussitism.
I think that this is really about power. And you know, you can't, there was no way the Lutheran princes having, you know, established this much power under themselves were ever going to go back to like just kowtowing to the Habsburgs, right? Like they were just not going to do it. And I think also partially it's because the Habsburgs were so powerful at this point in time. Like if you were going to go back to the really old school Holy Roman Empire where you elect the Holy Roman Emperor, and this is like buy-in from various electoral princes, and you know everyone has to do that. That's fine, but at this point in time, the Holy Roman Empire is just Habsburgs all the way down. And are you gonna say, "Oh yeah, absolutely, guys! Like, here's the keys to the kingdom. Yes, I will like kick in for your army. I'm paying for all this stuff." No, like absolutely not. So it's never going to take off in the lands where the Lutherans have already kind of like got a foothold, because it's just not in the interest of the ruling classes. So, you know, the Habsburgs are able to do it in places where they have more power, right? Like they're able to kind of like quash Hussitism because they, at this point in time, have hereditary claims to Bohemia suddenly, right? And so, you know, here they come. Here comes Rudolf just like marching into Prague and being like, "Oh, it's pretty here. I think I'll set up shop," you know? Which is kind of like good for.
Nice quasi-religion you got here. Be a shame if someone
Yeah.
crushed it.
Exactly. So, you know, what it ends up shaking down to is this kind of like hegemonic power that goes along with hereditary ruling, right? And so eventually everyone is just going to pick the thing which gives them the most power. And you're not going to put the genie back in the bottle for guys who have realized that they are going to be able to rule on their own. Like it's just not going to happen. And so if you can't get the head of the snake, then it doesn't matter, you know?
And it's like I think we talked about it last time. It's like the Counter-Reformation efforts that do succeed, you know, by definition in like France, it took like a few hundred years' effort and the crown gaining like insane amounts of power, and then eventually just wiping them the fuck out. So like, and again, you know, the ones that succeeded during the 30 Years' War, like in Bohemia and places like that, like they were fucking devastated in order to do that. And so like, if you were going to succeed on that level, you would have to be fine with like killing off like this huge percentage of the population of your empire and a huge percentage of the population of Europe, like broadly, and somehow have the army and capabilities to do that, like across your entire empire, which is something the Holy Roman Empire hasn't really ever had, at least not in hundreds of years by this point. So, yeah, it's just like once the genie's out of the bottle, you know, you have the people who, like the princes who do it for political gain, and you have, I mean, you know, a lot of wealthy people who do it for political gain. Then you have the people who are like true believers, and once that, you know, once you have that combo, it's just
Gah.
kind of fucked.
I mean, I suppose there's also like something to be said here too about like, yeah, you get the Counter-Reformation and stuff. And I read this really great book called Cosmos and Materiality in Early Modern Prague, and this historian just kind of analyzes what everybody owns, like all these different like wealthy families own in early modern Prague, and they are doing shit that is like not necessarily Catholic. It's like they own Protestant prayer books, and they own like weird magical implements, and they like own all kinds of different things. And they're like, yeah, you know, Christianity, I'm a Catholic. Fine. You know, it's like, so they do all these things where it's like, you know, nominally, as long as the Habsburgs can pat themselves on the back and they go, oh, yes, we've made everyone very Catholic. Like, that's what we're doing now. And look, we've got some Jesuits right here. Like, then they're fine. And, but regular people can kind of go about their business, where it's like it's not like the same level of kind of like personal policing, because you know, also Protestants are already all out in the world now. You get it at higher levels, like, you know, they're going to take back churches and things like that, but are they going to like roll up on a silversmith and be like, hey, you're not reading any Protestant prayers, are you? And like, no. It also, there's a disincentive for anyone to rebel against it as a result, because they're still kind of muddling along, I guess, right?
So that's our series on heresies and the Reformation. Pretty much just going to wrap it up here. The arc of the hegemonic Catholic Church, we'll say, you know. So from like 313 AD, when the practice of Christianity is legalized in the Roman Empire, and then after that it becomes a world religion, it gains a ton of power, becomes the official state religion. Its power grows. It outlasts the United Roman Empire and becomes hegemonic, develops the Holy Roman Empire. And then even when it had, you know, more money and power than probably any empire in history up to that point, it started to decline because, you know, people, the contradictions that mounted under it, and it tried to contain too much.
Yeah.
And it led to a precipitous collapse of power from, you know, 1517 to 1648. You went from hegemonic and Christianizing two entire new continents to making a religious settlement with a bunch of guys named after some dipshit monk who nailed some stuff to a door. And you know, and that ended your run. And yeah, so
good run,
you know, good run. Yep. Yep, thanks so long, and thanks for the memories, hegemonic Catholic Church. But don't worry, the podcast will stay with it, because it was still hegemonic in Europe during the Middle Ages.
Whoop, whoop.
And that is to which we will return next time. But thank you so much for listening. Check out the Patreon, subscribe, it helps us out. You can help us out by giving ratings, 5-star ratings and reviews on like Apple and Spotify. They tell me that helps out a lot.
I know it's annoying in a travel lodge, like, you know, let's see, or wherever the hell, I don't even know where I am. Discount hotels.
That's funny. I hate to put the onus on you, but unfortunately in this case that is how the podcast
blame the Puritans, man.
Yeah. All the Puritans' fault that Spotify is doing, Spotify and Apple are doing this. Thank you for listening. Eleanor, where can people find you and your work?
Yeah, so my book is out in the English-speaking world, people. Buy the Once in Future Sex. It's you can do that. That's a thing that you can do. German edition coming soon. That would be good, and that would help me a lot. If you've bought it, again, if you could review it, if you like it, that would also help. If you don't like it, take it to your grave. Thanks. You can find me on Twitter while it still exists. Huge question marks on that one. At Going Medieval. And then my blog, as always, is going-medieval.com.
Yep. You can find me, Lucas Amazing, on Twitter. I unfortunately believe that we are never getting out of the prison. And it will still be there.
It's just worse.
Well, we'll see. Who knows? He'll be gone soon enough. Either the state, the bank, either it'll be bankruptcy or the Saudis, you know, do their thing, whatever that thing is. Mm-hmm. Force him out of power, of course, and back into a shadow role. But anyway, you can also find my podcast, People's History of the Old Republic, wherever you're listening to this. It's about Star Wars. Check it out. Again, we do thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.